Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment. To friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 19th of March, 2014. This is Nav Briefing 117, The Planetary Vision Quest. So here it is, the day we've all been waiting for. It's just before dawn here, and I can see Venus rising over the southeastern horizon, over the ridge of the Crestallina Mountains. My black cat Nikita is sitting here on the desk, looking at me with her serene attitude of observation. What's up, Nikita? You gonna go out and watch the sunrise with me? This is the day. 3 years ago today, the entire world was watching the supermoon, as they called it. Millions of people around the world, many of them amateur astronomers, and many more of them, just ordinary people, watching this phenomenon, which occurs occasionally due to the moon being full at the moment of its perigee. Little did they know that what they were observing at that moment would be observed with intense interest and meticulous attention by a small group of people for the following 3 years. The Gaia Navigation Experiment was proposed for the purpose of monitoring the conditions of reset prior to the correction of the Aeon Sophia. And today, March 19th, is the final day of reset. Standing out on my terrace this morning, stepping out into the cool air of dawn, I see a sky that is almost totally clear. There are some clouds to the north, and there is a faint mist in the air, the dawn mist. And when I face directly west and look up at an angle of about 45 degrees, I can see Mars. And to the left of Mars, just having passed it on its transit, I can see what is called the Gibbous Moon, G-I-B-B-O-U-S. That is the lopsided moon that appears some 2 or 3 days after the full moon. So the moon is waning, that's the Gibbous Moon. Eventually it shrinks to the final quarter of the lunar cycle, which we call the hinge. So there's Mars and the Gibbous Moon, and slightly below the moon to the right, beneath Mars, is the star Spica, which the Egyptians called Mina. It marks the sheaf of wheat in the left hand of the Virgin. I propose that we call this star Spora. Now, the natural tendency of the eye, as it observes the sky, is to wander from one prominent star to another, naturally, without knowing anything about the patterns in the sky. Or even if you do, your eye will naturally wander to the more prominent stars, and it will trace the lines between these stars. So as I'm standing out there on the terrace, my line of sight tends to shift upward. And if I look up at a high angle, still looking west, exactly west, I can see the bright mark, the bright signal of Arcturus. This is the star that marks the constellation that used to be called Bootes, the Herdsman. But we in the GNE have renamed that constellation Braveheart, the constellation of the male warrior who carries Morbido. If you imagine a warrior in the style of a Plains Indian, in the style maybe of an Apache or Cherokee Indian, dressed in buckskins, naked legs, moccasins, or bare feet. He has the usual gear of shells and feathers, but on his head he wears the antlers of a stag. So he wears the antler headdress of a stag. The warrior pictured in the Braveheart constellation is kneeling on his feet, and between his hands there is a blade driven into the ground. Between his knees, the blade is driven into the ground and it glints brilliantly. And he reaches down with his hands and forms a mudra around the blade as if he were to protect it, as if he were to cup the shining light of the blade in his hands. Braveheart holds that light so that is the star we may call Silex. Well, Silex is a beautiful blade chipped from rock, from stone, as has been found in many prehistoric caves. So there is Braveheart kneeling in a protective gesture, cupping his hands around the blade that is inserted into the earth. This tells us that he gets his killing power from the earth itself, and he uses it for protection. And he protects others from that power so that they do not handle it wrongly. And you can often picture the constellations as communicating with each other. They actually gesture and look at each other across the vast reaches of the night sky. So there is Braveheart looking down with a steady and devoted gaze at the Virgin. And you can follow the line of his gaze by scanning your eyes down from Arcturus or Silex, which is positioned high in the sky, down to Spora. And it so happens that these two stars have exactly the same ecliptic longitude. That is to say that there is an alignment between them, that any planet that is in conjunction with Spora in the hand of the Virgin will also be in conjunction with Silex. Can you see that? Now, the line of celestial longitude is, of course, something that you must picture, and it may be a little problematical to do that, since celestial longitude is nothing but an abstract measure of the sky. You're required to superimpose a grid over the sky. Now, if you look at certain archonic sky-watching devices such as Stellarium, and you put in the grid of longitude or the grid of right ascension, it will show these lines running across the sky. But of course, they are a human convention. They are artificial. Nonetheless, I would say that what I see this morning, what I have observed over the last few mornings, proves that the cosmos itself, the starry universe, will sometimes assist you in how to observe it. Let's recall that the planet Mars is making a retrograde loop in the area of Spica or Spora. Mars has already moved past that star, moving from right to left, as you observe in the northern hemisphere. And now it has started to move back from left to right. Remember, the station of Mars occurred at the beginning of this month, in close timing along with the other two planetary stations, Saturn retrograde, Jupiter direct. So Mars is making a loop, but Mars stands above Spora, and lo and behold, it crosses the line that you would draw visually from Spora up to Silex. And so what Mars is doing while it's making its retrograde cycle, completing its retrograde cycle near Spora, is that it is showing the alignment between these two stars. It stands in the place that assists you to visualize that alignment. This is one of the omens of the conclusion of the GNE and the conclusion of reset. How do I read that omen? I read it like I read many omens, Mimetes, as an engagement, a responsibility, if you will, a mission to be undertaken. The omens sometimes define a mission. In this case, Mars, which is the planet of war, planet of the masculine principle of aggression, and the generic principle of self-assertion, planet that astrologically represents anger, figures in the omen as the instrument of this engagement. But what is really wonderful is to consider the alignment and cooperation of these two brilliant marking stars. I read the omen as a signal of the moment in the life of our species when the way of the warrior and the way of the shaman must be combined. And that combination will represent a path of action that has never existed before on this planet, namely the Kalika War Party. What is unique about the Kalika War Party, which is in fact displayed in this omen, the emergence of the Kalika War Party, what is unique about it is that it consists of members of teams who recognize the imperative need to combine shamanic and telestic investigation with acts of war, particularly psychic and psychological war. So this omen in the dawn sky, now illuminated by the gibbous moon on this particular morning, this particular morning of March 19th. This omen It's a powerful and inspiring one indeed, because it reunites those two elements of human experience, and it indicates that the moment has come to conduct psychological war upon the predators, just as they do upon the great majority of the population of this planet. It has become obvious for some time now that the human species is under attack, and there are many forms of this attack, as you know. We are being attacked through our food, we are being attacked through media, through the psychological programming and the mind control programming of media and education and politics and religion. The line of attack is vast, absolutely vast. You could say, in a sense, that the predators and psychopaths who have launched this attack upon the human species in their madness have really surrounded humanity, you know. They have surrounded the Anthropos. A human animal today who is awake and alive will look around, and anywhere that he or she looks, you will see the assault upon humanity, the assault upon sanity, the assault upon the innocence of the Anthropos, which is its divinity, and upon the beauty of this planet and this experiment. You don't have to go looking for the battle lines, do you? But what happens now, at the beginning of correction, is that the Kalika War Party takes formation on the battle line. It takes formation in the field of Kurukshetra. And the omen indicating that moment is as clear as can be. Now, standing on my terrace and looking up at a 45 degree angle, there is Mars below it. Spica or Spora, slightly to the left, is the moon. And if I scan further to the left, as I would automatically tend to do, my eyes would automatically tend to do that, because I can see out of the corner of my eye a bright light. So my eye scans upward to the left, and bingo, there's Saturn, located at the fulcrum of the scales, also making its retrograde loop. Well, I explained to you in the previous briefing that the retrograde loop, which takes 5 months of Saturn around the beam of the scales, the vertical beam, the support beam, represents the emergent teaching, if you will, of Gaian ethics. As I watch the gibbous moon, I know that it's going to move from right to left, and at some time within the next 48 hours, it will pass in front of the planet Saturn. There are a number of lunar occultations of Saturn proceeding now through 2014, although they may not always be visible depending on your latitude on the planet and depending on the time of day they happen. These occultations of Saturn represent dramatic moments leading to what I would call, well, let's say, the declaration of Gaian ethics. This is not the declaration of independence. This is not the declaration of human rights, as if rights were already given to us by God or by the goddess herself. No. This is a declaration of Gaian ethics, which is the framework in which we all agree that rights are nothing but human conventions. They're nothing but agreements. And so, if I continue to allow my eye to scan to the left, it automatically locates another bright star. We're looking at stars and planets here. It automatically locates another bright light, which I can identify as Antares in the heart of the Scorpion. By the time that Saturn reaches Antares, the death protocols of Scorpion Mother will have been entirely implemented. So I spoke a little bit about those death protocols when I described the action of her venom. Her venom is secreted in derivatives of ozone. So if you listen to the addendum to the talk on the Omen of War, somewhere between minute 6 and minute 27, you will hear a digression on that subject. And from Antares, in the heart of the Scorpion, if I scan way, way around, tracing over the outline of the mountains of Africa to the south, and turning left until I face east, then I see Venus. Venus in the arc of the goatfish. And that is the omen of war, which seems to be reflected quite dramatically in the drama of geopolitics and in the situation in Ukraine that is currently unfolding before the eyes of the entire world. So there's your picture. There's your panorama of celestial writing. On the last day of Sophia's reset. Now, if you take a moment to consider that panorama, stretching across the sky from west to east, from Mars to Venus, I think you will agree with me that it presents a complete and perfect display of the result of the GNE. It confirms, in a way, our total and impeccable concordance with the conditions of reset. Reading the sky on this morning is, for me, a sublime experience of confirmation. Remember that I said that the Aztecs observed the reappearance of Venus from the underworld, or Xibalba, as an omen indicating to them the conditions of war. Well, the conditions of war have been shown, they have appeared in the world in a vivid and explicit fashion over the last 2 months, corresponding to Venus's emergence from the underworld. There is a page on the internet called the Ukraine Uprising Timeline. It's a BBC page. Just search for Ukraine Uprising or Ukraine Revolution Timeline, and you will find a chronological account of events proceeding from the end of January into February, and you will find that the decisive moments of those events in Ukraine follow exactly the reemergence of Venus from the underworld. For instance, consider the moment at the end of January when the acting prime minister of that time resigned And significantly, Parliament annulled the anti-protest law and granted amnesty to those who had been arrested in protests. Well, that was a signal to inflame a massive series of demonstrations. And that signal corresponds exactly to the moment when Venus, which had already been visible in the early morning sky, very, very low, for a couple of weeks, turned direct. It turned direct in an alignment above the constellation of the Archer to the star Sigma Sagittarii, or Nunci, which marks the vane of the arrow, which, of course, is the place where the Archer pulls back the string. So what could be more vivid than that? The events in Ukraine correspond to the sky writing in a most meticulous manner. And if you follow the timeline, actually it's called the Ukraine crisis timeline, if you follow the timeline forward from there, you'll see that every single event corresponds to the appearance of Venus as the Aztec omen of war. Also, you want to take special notice of the woman who plays a role in these events, Julia Tymoshenko. You'll see a picture of her there. She was released from prison. Tymoshenko. Julia Tymoshenko is the Aryan warrior woman of Ukraine. And around her, she is the iconic figure around which the fate of Ukraine shall now be determined. And as goes the fate of Ukraine, goes the fate of Russian-American relationships. And as that fate goes, goes the fate of the entire planet, geopolitically speaking. I'd like to point out a little correction. I'd like to take a few moments here to make a few corrections regarding things I've said in the previous briefing on the omen of war. Regarding Russia and Bharat, Bharat is the ancient name for India. So Mahabharata means the great story of India. And I said that Russia today is the equivalent of Bharat in the time of the Bhagavad Gita. That was at the initial moment of Kali Yuga, 3102 BC. Well, we'll just have you recall that the story of the Mahabharata is extremely complicated, but essentially it consists of a war between two clans. The clan of our Arjuna is the Pandavas, not the Pandas, the Pandavas. So the Pandavas are one clan fighting another clan. And although these two clans have distinct identities, they are related by bonds of kinship. So Arjuna protests against fighting against his own kin. The analogy I wish to draw to your attention regarding the Venusian omen of war and its relevance to the Ukraine is that America and Russia today are like the two warring tribes of Bharat in the Mahabharata. They are the two tribes. And so to identify Russia directly with Bharat is not correct. Both Russia and America together are Bharat in the 21st century. And it is now at this moment in the 21st century that the Battle of Kurukshetra recommences. This time, the entire planet is involved in the battle. This time, the discourse of Krishna recorded in the Mahabharata, assumes another form. It comes to expression in Gayan warrior tactics and in the formulation of Gayan ethics. So it would be well to go back and read the Bhagavad Gita. You can read the Penguin edition of the translation by Juan Mascaro. It's easy to read, easy to find, and easy to read. You can read it in an hour or two and meditate on the questions that are raised in that document, which is considered to be one of the top five sacred texts on this planet. You know, there's a book called When the Swans Came to the Lake. I believe the author is Rick Fields, was a prominent American Buddhist back in the 70s and 80s. This book describes the coming of Buddhism to America, the coming of Asian philosophy in general and Buddhism in particular. And one of the key event in that transmission, which is part of the Vajrayana romance, which is overseen by Swandeva, who also oversees the completion of Reset. You get the thread here, my friends? One of the key events in that transmission was the arrival in the eastern colonies of the first English translation of the Bhagavad Gita. And Rickfield describes how that small volume, which at the time was an extremely, extremely rare item, needless to say, came into the hands of Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau. So they read and discussed the question in the Bhagavad Gita, which is, how does the divine plan upon this planet account for war, killing, and murder? And Emerson actually wrote a poem which paraphrases and summarizes what he found to be the message in the Bhagavad Gita. And that poem is called Brahma. And it goes like this. If the red slayer thinks he slays, or if the slain think he is slain, they know not well the subtle ways I keep and pass and turn again. Far or forgot to me is near. Shadow and sunlight are the same. The vanished gods to me appear, and one to me are shame and fame. They reckon ill who leave me out. When me they fly, I am the wings. I am the doubter and the doubt. I am the hymn the Brahmin sings. The strong gods pine for my abode, and pine in vain the sacred seven. But thou, meek lover of the good, find me and turn thy back on heaven. So in that little poem, Emerson recognized the startling outcome of the Bhagavad Gita, namely that the Lord Krishna, who is disguised as Arjuna's charioteer, but who actually represents the presence of the aeonic observation of this experiment, as well as the aeonic power of love, advises Arjuna to fight and not to desist from fighting. So, it's well worth noting, my friends, that the first text of the sacred literature of the East that came into the hands of the American Transcendentalists, a key episode in the Vajrayana romance illustrated by the thread joining the tales of the two whales. That event, that moment, carries the message of the responsibility to fight and not to resign oneself to pacifism. Now, I'm not saying that the code of the Kalika War Party It's just a rewrite or remake, a rehash, as it were, of the message in the Bhagavad Gita. But I am saying this loud and clear. If you want to be in position to realize the code of the Kalika War Party and to formulate it in your own life, then you may want to take the Bhagavad Gita as a reference. It is indeed a quintessential statement of warrior ethics at that time and that place, the initial moment of Kali Yuga. And now it comes forth in the culminating moment of Kali Yuga in the last two centuries would be, I would say, a deepening and extrapolation of that message. So there you go. Here is another point of clarification I'd like to make as I come around the half-hour mark of this briefing regarding my invocation of the Aztecs and the Aztec war complex, if you will. You may have been somewhat surprised by that introduction, or even alarmed. The subject of the Aztecs, let's face it, is pretty gruesome. If you read The Conquest of Mexico by Hugh Thomas, well, you're certainly going to find the lurid details of cannibalism and the practice of deviant forms of shamanism among the Aztecs. It's really pretty awful. So why would I appear to raise the name of the Aztecs as if I were indicating that they present some kind of standard for the Kalika War Party? Well, they do and they don't. In the first place, let me tell you how they don't. It so happens that Aztec culture was dominated by the cult of the sun god Nanahuatl or Nanahuatzin, which means covered with sores, and that may be a reference to the sunspots, the appearance of sunspots on the face of the sun. Paradoxically, Nanahuatl in Aztec mythology was considered to be a benevolent god who sacrificed himself in order to become the sun, but then, by a perverse twist of imagination, the sun in turn required the sacrifice of human animals to provide him with blood from alive, bleeding hearts so that he could continue to exist. Now, this myth is almost single-handedly the creation of one psychotic individual whose name is very difficult to pronounce, Tlacaelel. Tlacaelel, T-L-A-C-A-E-L-E-L, was the advisor to four emperors, including Moctezuma. He was, in fact, the handler of the Aztec emperors. Now, it so happens that this nefarious, obsessed, and demented individual is largely responsible for the record that we have of the Aztecs, because he rewrote the history of the Aztecs to his liking, and he destroyed the remaining or extant history of the Toltecs that would have been available to the Aztecs in their own time, that is to say about 500 or 600 years ago, just before the conquest. So we today don't really know anything about what the Aztecs were apart from the overwriting of this nefarious shaman. Nor do we really have any idea who the Toltecs were. I can assure you that they were not cannibals like the Aztecs, and that they were largely in great contrast to the Aztecs, they were a peaceful culture. They were a culture of peaceful warriors and artists and artisans The word Toltec means artists. They were artists not only in the sense of the physical arts of sculpture, architecture, painting, pottery, all those various handicrafts, as it were, but they were also artists at the level of the mind and psyche and imagination. They were masters of magic. Indeed, I have argued that it was due to the magic spell that Toltecs cast upon the Aztecs, that Aztec civilization, from its origins, was doomed. The Aztecs saw the return of Quetzalcoatl absurdly, ridiculously, in the figure of Hernando Cortez. But as a matter of fact, that is actually how it turned out to be. Because when the actual combines with the imagined, then you have a situation where the magical or imaginative power of the human animal drives its behavior and shapes the actual circumstances and conditions of historical events. So, due to the overriding of the true history of the Toltecs, and due to the destruction of the history of the Aztecs, even in their own time, and the replacement of their true history and their true tribal mythology by a lying narrative, well, we don't really know what went on in those times, and the only way we can find out, as far as I know, is to go back and access the specific chronicles in the memory banks of the Aeon Sophia, where the true account of those events has been preserved. So what I can tell you now is that Tezcatlipoca, the Lord of the Smoking Mirror, was a Toltec sorcerer. And he was so named because of his ability as a sky diviner. What is the smoking mirror? It is the night sky seen through the low jungle mist. The night sky is black. The Toltecs used black mirrors, mirrors of obsidian, for divining. The shaman who divines with a black obsidian mirror and at the same time reads the sky through the layer of jungle mists as if he were reading in a mirror is the Lord of the Smoking Mirror, Tezcatlipoca. Now, Quetzalcoatl was arguably also a Toltec, but in fact more of a crossover figure between the Toltecs and the Aztecs. So the famous magical contest between those two shamans, Tezcatlipoca and Quetzalcoatl, has a great deal to teach us, and that would be the starting point to understand some of the deeper and occluded mysteries of Mesoamerican culture, okay? Bear in mind that neither Tezcatlipoca nor Quetzalcoatl were the war god of the Aztecs. The war god of the Aztecs was called Huitzilopochtli. And Huitzilopochtli, who was always invoked by the Aztecs in their tribal wars, was the figure who represented the warrior impulse, the perverted warrior impulse of the Aztec society as it was framed in the mythology of sun sacrifice. I pointed out years ago in Santa Fe that the Aztec myth, the late invented, overwritten Aztec myth that demands the sacrifice of human lives and the blood streaming from the heart torn out of the body, that whole imagery is transposed into the nuclear Cold War confrontation. It is the same mythology, the mythology that drives the nuclear global confrontation Cold War, Hot War scenario, which is now reaching a boiling point in Ukraine, is just a makeover or transformation of the Aztec sun sacrifice complex. It's a psychosis. It's the same psychosis under two different guises. So you see, it's extremely important to recognize today that we don't know the hidden heart and beauty and nobility of Aztec culture, nor of Toltec culture, any more than we know the hidden heart and beauty and power of our own destiny as Anthropos today. Because it has been overwritten by the scenario of geopolitical struggle and geopolitical polarization of one country against another. That's not my story. That's not my myth. I'm not living on a planet which is dominated by a mythology of war. But the planet I live on, the society, the social order in the planet I live on, is driven and manipulated by the mythology of war, just in the same way that the Aztecs were. But behind that, you find the true Aztecs. You get a glimpse of the true Aztecs when you read Aztec Thought and Culture by Leon Portilla. And I have to tell you that he uses a word in there. Let me go find it. Well, the Spanish word is sabio, but the Nahuatl word is tlamatini, T-L-A-M-A-T-I-N-I. Obviously, a lot of Nahuatl words begin with T-L-A. And tlamatini really means the sage, the sapient one, the wise man, and it really means the telestus. It's interesting that there is a kind of transposition between the Greek telos, which is T-E-L-O-S, and this root, T-L-A. In any case, starting from his first chapter on the birth of philosophy, Leon Portilla describes the characteristics of these wise men among the Nahuatl people of Mesoamerica, and these are exactly the characteristics of a telestus, or Gnostic master, in the Levantine Mysteries. So there is no doubt that there was a benevolent and initiated culture of high intellectual achievement and also of high aesthetic and erotic achievement among the Aztecs. I can assure you of that, and I can assure you that we have not been able to access that due to the way in which the Aztec mythology has been presented to us, not to mention the way in which the Aztecs have been represented in the script or narrative of those who conquered them. So this Aztec story becomes a focus of interest and study for those of us now who would place ourselves in the Calico War Party with the transition from reset to correction. Now you might wonder why I emphasize Aztec rather than Toltec. There has been something of a Toltec revival going on ever since Castaneda, of course. Couldn't overlook that, could we? But I don't find the Toltec revival going anywhere, honestly. Maybe I'm missing something. But I would make two brief observations. First of all, the Toltec revival has come to assume the form of a kind of popular shamanic path that might be associated with psychoactive plants. And in the manner in which it's been taught, it doesn't contain the initiatives of the warrior path that we need to find now in the Planetary Vision Quest. Entering the warrior path is the human role for participation in Sophia's correction. Well, you might have heard about the four agreements, which is a meme attached to the Toltec culture that has been circulating by circulated by some teachers over the last few decades. Go read the four agreements. I don't find anything in them at all. They're insipid. I don't find any power in the Toltec revival, frankly. The Toltecs were peaceful warriors, and there is room and a necessity for peaceful warriors in the Calico War Party, so I leave the door open for a peaceful powwow with the Toltecs. But we are taking a hard look at the Aztecs here, because Aztec culture and civilization mirrors more closely than any other the insanity and addiction, cannibalism, and murderous blood-mongering thirst for power than any other recent culture. Aztecs are us. They are the mirror of us. But we must also be able to look through that mirror to the genuine spiritual nobility of the Aztecs. Now, if you're going to spend the next few months making some investigations in this area, let me clue you very quickly to these guidelines. Tezcatlipoca is the benevolent sorcerer and sky diviner of the Toltecs. Quetzalcoatl was also half Toltec, half Aztec, and represents the crossover figure from Toltec culture in one vector toward the Aztecs and as well in another vector toward the Maya. All right. Huitzilopochtli is truly the war god of the Aztecs, and that's the one to look out for. The name Huitzilopochtli means hummingbird on the left. What is the hummingbird on the left? Well, it is TLE, or temporal lobe epilepsy, which affects the left lobe of the human brain and in turn causes abnormalities in the left lobe, which in turn exaggerate the effects of TLE. Now, TLE, or temporal lobe epilepsy, is not like other forms of epilepsy. You should go and read about the characteristics of it. And one of them is a tendency to dance and to commit acts of violence in a blackout state. If you want to understand the warrior insanity of the Aztecs rather than their warrior sanity, I ask you to consider that a large part of their warrior clans, as well as almost entirely their ruling elite, were afflicted with TLE that came on and was exaggerated, or let's say TLE that was triggered and worsened by chocoholism. They were addicted to chocolate, black raw chocolate, which they would snuff as a powder. And they would snuff it out of silver dishes that were placed in ice and snow from the peaks of the nearby mountains, Popocatl, Petl, and Ixtapalotl. Runners would come down from the mountains with snow. They would place these silver dishes full of cocoa powder in the snow so that they became frigid, and then they would snort that frigid powder into their nostrils, directly into the brain. The result of these practices was chocoholism and severe cerebral derangement with a high frequency of TLE. So, I venture to explain the behavior of the Aztecs in their ritual war dances and in their out-of-their-mind states of murderous rage and cannibalism, which they undertook as they raided the neighboring tribes. I venture to explain that in large measure by the phenomenon of TLE. You know, hummingbird on the left, they had the left side buzz in their brains. So, hummingbird on the left is a metaphor or mythological trope, if you will, for the left side rush or left side buzz produced by TLE. Now, in concluding this briefing, I'd like to return to the subject of war. And I'd like to ask myself a question. Me, the navigator, asking myself a question in front of all of you, so that you in turn can ask this question. Well, if we allow ourselves to enter and live that myth and that metaphor of war, what is the war we are undertaking against? What are we warring against? Now, at the beginning of this briefing, I described the battle lines. Quite familiar sight to all of you, I'm sure. Well, of course, it's become apparent by this time, early in the 21st century, that those decent, honest, and well-intentioned human animals who simply want to live in peaceful coexistence are at war with psychopaths and intra-species predators going all the way up to the Zads, who have a completely different agenda. And the psychopaths and the Zads clearly do not embrace the beauty of Gaia. They are not enthralled and humbled by the mysterious prospect of this experiment, nor do they want to live in peaceful coexistence with anyone. So you could say that we in the Calico War Party are engaged in a war against those human specimens of the 3D affliction of division, deception, and domination. Clear enough, but I propose that you also consider that we are actually in a war against suffering. To speak in psychological terms, that would be more accurate. It's about a war on suffering. It's about a war on, but more specifically, on that suffering which occurs in this world due to the deliberate actions of some human animals. Now, I'm not against suffering as such. Suffering comes along with the human condition. And we may suffer in various ways, as all animals do, due to various circumstances, due to things that happen to us. I'm not talking in that sense about suffering. I'm talking about the specific suffering that is deliberately brought into the world and sustained by the behavior of certain human animals. We're not merely at war against those animals, but we are at war against the suffering that they introduce. Now, in this context, it might be good to go back and review briefly the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism. And I propose to reformulate them as the Four Ignoble Truths. So first of all, what are the Four Noble Truths? Well, they were taught by the historical Buddha in this way. The first is the truth of dukkha, or suffering. The second is the truth about the origin of suffering. The third is the truth about the sensation of suffering. And the fourth is the truth about the path that leads to that cessation. So, sarvam dukkham, all is suffering. Everything is suffering. This was the message given by the historical Buddha to his contemporaries, externally and conventionally. It was not the message given to his inner circle. The world is a mess. It's the middle of Kali Yuga, the midpoint of Kali Yuga. It can only get worse. If you're not suffering now, you will be soon. The nature of existence is dukkha, suffering. That's point one. Point two, what is the cause or origin of this suffering? That is trishna in Sanskrit, or tanha in Pali, craving, desire, craving.
the historical Buddha, Siddhartha proposed that we consider that the origin of all suffering, now he didn't distinguish between whether this was internal and spontaneous suffering that might occur in a human animal, or whether it was suffering that would be due to the harming committed by one human upon another, or by a human upon the non-human world, which also suffers. He didn't make that distinction. It doesn't matter. He made a blanket statement. The origin of all this suffering is craving. Point three, what is the sensation of the suffering? Terminate the craving. Easy enough. Point four, what is the way to terminate the craving? You're hardly going to believe this. Anyway, as the solution to terminate the craving, which is the origin of suffering, which is what screws up everything in the world and makes life so unpleasant, is to follow the path of right action. And so there are eight things that you need to do, eight behavioral norms, which are called the eight forms of right action. Now this whole program of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Noble Path was nothing but a placebo. It is completely ineffectual. First of all, it doesn't have anything to do with enlightenment. Do you get that? Why would Buddha, who was the enlightened one, teach a program of behavioral norms to the human race that has absolutely nothing to do with enlightenment? The reason is because he perceived at the midpoint of Kali Yuga that it was necessary to appease people and to give them a placebo that would allow them to deal with the intense suffering into which humanity was going to enter in Kali Yuga for the remaining 2,500 years. And so he gave this teaching out externally and conventionally to the world. It's completely inefficacious. It means nothing whatsoever. Nobody gets anything out of practicing the Eightfold Noble Path. And nobody can really exterminate the root of craving, because if you exterminate the root of craving in your own being, in your body-mind entity as a human animal, you would die. Because you're only alive because you crave to live. All that is alive wants to live. Don't you see? All that is alive craves to live. So Buddha's proposition on the face of it is not only erroneous, it is ironical in the sense that it excludes a great part of the truth. And it is merely a boondoggle. It's a distraction. It's a misdirection. It's a ridiculous placebo. Nobody in their right mind today would give 2 seconds of serious thought to the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Noble Path. It's worthless. On the other hand, what Buddha taught to his inner circle of disciples, consisting primarily of 4 men and 4 women who had received direct mind transmission from him, that is to say, they had been able to realize the nature of mind exactly as he himself realized it, and they were Mahakasyapa, Subhuti, Arjuna, his cousin, and 5 others. To them, he gave an entirely different instruction. And that instruction comes forth today after centuries of oral preservation in the true Tantra for the planet. Today, Kala Tantra. Not the liberation from desire, but liberation through desire. So much for the 4 Noble Truths. What about the 4 Ignoble Truths? Okay, here you go. I'm making them up right now. 1, the truth of suffering is that there is a suffering upon this planet that is imposed and inflicted by certain human animals and needs to be distinguished as such. It needs to be identified as such. It is not suffering that spontaneously arises in the human soul because we can grow and learn and become more beautiful and honest and genuine through suffering, but it is a cruel suffering imposed. 1st Ignoble Truth. Some human beings impose suffering on others. Well, what is the origin of this? Second noble truth. The origin is the fracking behavior and mindset of those who impose this suffering. Clear? All right. What's the third noble truth? What is the cessation of this imposed suffering, this imposed form of cruelty, this nefarious and evil brutality, this domination and crushing of the human spirit and massacre of innocence according to an agenda of racist supremacy that originates with the Zads and has spread to all their accessories and proxies, such as the Jesuits, such as the Christians, such as the Catholics, okay? So now we ask about the third noble truth. What is the cessation of all that suffering? Well, I tell you what you already know in your minds and hearts, as clear as day. It is the cessation of those who cause it. It is the termination. It is the destruction of that behavior and those who conduct it. Period. Now, the cessation of that kind of suffering, and you must always focus your mind on the kind of suffering that is meant here, okay? Requires a fourth point. It requires a path of application. It requires a method. So, what is the method for achieving the cessation of that kind of suffering, that kind of behavior conducted by those kinds of human animals? Well, it is a warrior path, a warrior practice. It is the Calico War Party. You know, I am really happy to be able to tell you this today on the concluding day of the GNE. Really happy because, especially, well, for a lot of reasons, happy to be have completed my mission. Can believe that, you know. Now I can fix the visor, the sun visor on my car, you know. I can, like, sweep the patio at Ambergain. You'll find me sweeping the patio at Ambergain now. But I'm particularly happy because this morning it came to me, not long after dawn, that I can say exactly what the world needs. I know exactly, in one sentence, in two words, I know how to solve all the problems on this planet. It's finally come to me, as it is bound to come to many, many people. The final word that I want to say to you about anticipation, going from reset into correction, is that you can anticipate that the obvious will become super obvious. So what has become obvious in the 3 years of reset, now, immediately as correction is underway, becomes super obvious, screamingly obvious. And what I'm going to say to you now is screamingly obvious, but I don't think anyone has said it so far, because it involves the use of a particular word that has not been used in the manner in which I shall now demonstrate. What does the world need? What is the solution for the mess that is taking place in the social order on this planet? The world needs a warrior class. That is the operative word. A warrior class. You could even say, if you wanted to, because the word class is highly contaminated, you could say a warrior caste. Now go back to the Mahabharata. Go back. Wind your memory back 5,000 years to the battle line of Kurukshetra. And you will find on that battle line two different clans or families confronting each other, right? And they are called the Pandavas, to whom Arjuna belonged, I believe, and the Kauravas, Kauravas. This was the other clan. These two clans are facing each other. Today, this scenario comes to be reenacted and represented on a global scale in the confrontation between Russia and the United States, currently focused in Ukraine. Now, it so happens that in the case of the Mahabharata, a good number of the characters in that story belonged to the warrior caste. Remember that Hindu society was a caste system. So the Brahmins were the spiritual class or caste. There was a merchant caste. There was the warrior caste. And there were the outcasts who were not of any caste at all. Bring forward that concept of the caste system into the world today. And you see that it really fits in a way. According to the agenda of the Zads, they would like to see all of the Goyim be the outcasts, to be no caste at all, to be reduced to poverty and enslavement. And they would reign over us, and each one of them would have 2,800 Goy to serve him or her. This is their dream. And they would not only have more money and treasure than anyone else on the planet, which they already do, but they would have it all. That's their dream. You can transpose the Mahabharata scenario into the present and fit in these pieces. But here's the trick, my friends. A good many of the characters among the Pandavas and among the Kauravas belonged to the warrior caste. And in the situation today, I ask you, who is in the warrior caste? Who is in the warrior class? There is no warrior class on this planet that would serve for the defense of the planet. So far. That is what the world needs. It needs a warrior class to defend society against psychopaths and predators in our own midst. And this warrior caste can be drawn from all levels of society and all people all around the world. They are all united by one common enemy, and that is, first, the self-declared enemies of humanity, the Zadokite Talmudic Jumans. And second, anyone who is proxy or accessory to their program. They are the causes of suffering on this planet. Human caused suffering. Human implemented suffering. Human perpetrated suffering. And according to the third ignoble truth, the cessation of that suffering is the cessation, destruction, and termination of those human animals who foster it. That is a simple truth. I've said before, and many people who have been commenting over the last 2 or 3 years on psychopathy have said, that psychopaths and, by extension, people suffering from psychosis do not calculate the consequences of their own actions even for themselves. The people who are running the agenda of looting and murder on this planet cannot stop themselves, nor can they be converted, nor can they be sufficiently punished, what are we going to do? What does punishing them mean? Putting them in prison? What happens to them in prison? They become the charge of the public. It becomes our responsibility to feed, clothe, and shelter them. I don't want to feed, clothe, and shelter George Soros or any of his minions. I don't want to feed, clothe, and shelter any of the people in the military-industrial complex who have sold out to the war game. I don't want to be taking care of these people with my hard-earned money and my taxes. Do you? Now, the solution is not to punish them. The solution is to eliminate them. And in order to implement that solution, there must be a movement upon this planet, a self-defined movement that I call the Gaian warrior class in defense of life and love and beauty and peace. And some of them will be peaceful warriors and some of them will not. Okay? There's room in the warrior party for all types of action in defense of the earth and the life of humanity as an expression of the Anthropos. In fact, I have right here on my desk a sketch of the full ranks of the Kalika Warrior Party with the various Mahavidyas and Dakinis correlated to each rank. So in concluding, I want to make two remarks. First, about the Planetary Vision Quest. The Dakini in the Shakti Cluster who guides and leads the Planetary Vision Quest is Matangi. She is identified with the constellation of the Manitou, the transformation of the water bearer of Aquarius, and she is related to the Misotis, the spirit of the wilderness. What you and I have been doing for the last 3 years in the Gaian navigation experiment is forging a passage through the wilderness of pain and confusion in which humanity is currently lost. We have forged a passage, a way ahead, like a mountain pass into the frontier of a new world. The GNE is that pathway, and through that pathway, others follow. We have set an example of a rite of passage for the entire human race, and we have set down the markers and the guidelines concerning how that rite of passage must be conducted. So the Planetary Vision Quest you undertake consists of four steps. First, you do the Gaian Tantric vow and dedicate yourself to living your story, realizing that your life is not your own. Second, you find your guardian or power animal consistent with the paradigm of the vision quest in indigenous cultures. Your guardian then is one of the Mahavidyas or Diamond Sky Dakinis of the Shakti Cluster. Third, you assume your place in the Kalika War Party. Now the rank that you stand in, for instance, could be the rank of Bhairavi, or the rank of Shodashi, or the rank of Kurukula. And the Dakini who oversees your rank is not necessarily the same as your guardian Dakini, but it can be. So you may have two guardian Dakinis, one who guards your life and directs you in your life, and the other who oversees the rank where you stand in the Kalika War Party. They may be the same guardian, they may not. There is room for a lot of wonderful variations in this formation. Finally, four, we all recognize that Matangi is the guardian of the vision quest for humanity. Bear in mind that the constellation of the Manitou, or Aquarius, stands opposite the constellation of the Lion, which represents the warrior caste and the nobility of the warrior ideal of humanity. That is what saves humanity. The salvation of humanity is in the voluntary creation of a warrior class to protect life against human predators. To protect life itself and the social order against human predators. This is what the world needs. I'm happy to say that to you today, and I will follow up on these remarks in the final briefing, number 118. But on the second point, I wish to close this briefing. I return again to the subject of suffering, and I would read you this brief passage from the Zen teaching of Hui Hai on sudden illumination. Once somebody inquired, "Suppose a man is sitting in a boat and the boat keel cuts to death a shellfish. Is the man guilty, or should the boat be blamed?" The master answered, "Man and boat had no mind to kill the shellfish, and the only person to be blamed is you. When a tearing wind snaps off a branch which falls and kills somebody, there is no murderer and no murdered. In all the world, there is no place where living beings do not have to suffer." End quote. And if I might be permitted a brief comment, I would say that the master's response is full of nuance. When he speaks of the inevitability of suffering, I sense a reference to this vital distinction as well. The suffering that comes on its own, the branch falling from a tree, and the suffering that comes from human behavior inflicted by one animal upon another. And we even suffer to know the difference between those two kinds of suffering, don't we? So there is no end to this suffering, but the distinction is true. The distinction is pristine, and the distinction is unavoidable. To fail to make that distinction about the origin of suffering cripples the ability to act when the origin comes from human behavior. And in that crippling, in that failure, humanity acts out over and over again its betrayal of itself and of its most noble potential. But the path of the Gaian war class, the option of the Gaian war class, is the remedy to that betrayal. I rest my case.